The Spanish Inquisition, the expulsion of the Jews, the conquest of Granada, and Columbus's voyages to the Americas. All four of these historical events evoke complex reactions, hailed by some as moments of triumph and by others as examples of rabid intolerance. These events are intricately bound to the reigns of Fernando and Isabel, king of the Crown of Aragon and queen of Castile in the 15th and early 16th centuries. As architects of these events, Fernando and Isabel are sometimes described as founders of modern Spain, the monarchs who unified the disparate Spanish kingdoms into a polity known as Spain, while simultaneously unifying its inhabitants under one faith, Catholicism. But can we really characterize their reigns by unification? What do we lose historically by doing so? And what impact can such a characterization have on our present? In today's podcast episode, I speak with Dr. Mark Meyerson to answer these questions. Mark Meyerson is a professor of history and medieval studies at the University of Toronto, where he teaches courses on pre-modern Spanish history and pre-modern Mediterranean history, as well as courses on the history of violence. Among his publications are The Muslims of Valencia in the Age of Fernando and Isabel, Between Coexistence and Crusade, and A Jewish Renaissance in 15th Century Spain. He and co-authors Tom Berman and Brian Catlos have just completed a textbook on pre-modern Mediterranean history, The Sea in the Middle, The Mediterranean, 650 to 1650, with a companion source reader, Text from the Middle. And he is currently finishing a monograph on violence, religion, and the transformation of Spain, 1300 to 1614, to be published by Oxford University Press.
Thank you so much, Mark, for taking the time to speak with me today about these concepts of unification and conversion in the 15th century. I really appreciate you doing so. So the idea behind this is just to introduce the students to how these two terms, this unification and conversion, impact our understanding of the 15th century, but in particular, how they are connected to the figures of Fernando and Isabel, who loom so large in medieval Spanish history. So let's start with some foundations. Our episode today focuses on this concept of unification as connected both historiographically, but also in popular culture with late medieval Spain. So what is this unification that is being referred to in these discussions?
I think the principal aspect of unification that, well, it has two threads, but the principal one is the political one. And what we have happening with the marriage of Fernando and Isabel is the union of this couple, but also through their union, the union of Castile to the crown of Aragon. However, it's a union, but it's not a unification. Is to say that each of the two realms retained its own specific institutions, its separate representative assemblies, its separate administrative councils, etc., until the early 18th century. So we have this union of the couple, and it's important to keep in mind as well that Isabel was regarded as the ruler of Castile, and Fernando was regarded as the ruler of Aragon. Now, they did rule together, although they spent the majority of their reign in Castile. Why? Because Castile was the much larger realm, both geographically and demographically, around 6 million inhabitants in Castile compared to around 1 million in the Crown of Aragon. So the couple relied more on Castile's resources and military power to achieve what it is they wanted to achieve. Also have to keep in mind, when I talk about the realms having separate institutions, they also had very distinct political traditions. So Castile, to speak very generally, monarchy was more authoritarian and the representative assemblies, the Cortes, was weak, which meant that in Castile, the monarchs could very often get their way. In the Crown of Aragon, there was a strong tradition of what they called pactismo, which is to say a kind of contractual relationship between the monarchy and their representative assemblies. And monarchs were much more constrained in terms of what they could actually do, whether it was taxing their subjects or passing new laws, etc. And it's important to remember as well that in the Crown of Aragon, it was composed of three parts: the Kingdom of Aragon itself, the Principality of Catalonia, and the Kingdom of Valencia, as well as the Balearic Islands, Mallorca, Menorca, and Ibiza. And each of these separate components of the Crown of Aragon had its own representative assembly. So when Fernando and Isabel wanted to get things done in the Crown of Aragon, they often found it very frustrating, and Isabel had no patience at all for the peoples of the Crown of Aragon. So that's something to keep in mind when we think their reign, and really this union. And I should point out also that Fernando spent much of his reign, even though he was the king of the Crown of Aragon, in Castile, and he ruled the Crown of Aragon through what was called the Council of Aragon, through various Aragonese, Catalan, and Valencian advisors. So he was in close contact with what was going on there. But really, he focused a lot more on Castilian affairs and drew upon Castilian resources. But this union, if we speak in dynastic terms, in terms of who would inherit Castile and the Crown of Aragon, it was very fragile. We tend to think that because Fernando and Isabel were married, that necessarily Spain was now united and their heirs were going to inherit the whole thing. But in fact, after Isabel's death, in 1504, she predeceased Fernando by 12 years. Fernando was quite weak in Castile. He remarried to a French princess, and had that marriage produced an heir, that child would have inherited the Crown of Aragon. So the Crown of Aragon would not have been united with Spain, but it didn't produce an heir. And also, Fernando and Isabel's daughter, Juana, married Philip of Burgundy. They did not survive to inherit Castile or the Crown of Aragon, but their grandson, who became the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, was half Spanish and half Habsburg. He was the one who inherited this thing we now call Spain, but it very easily could have gone very differently. And one final thing to remember also in terms of the fragility of this union and the kind of contingency of history and how just out of luck, in a way, Castile and the Crown of Aragon became Spain, is that the peoples of the Crown of Aragon are often not too happy with the arrangement. Throughout Fernando and Isabel, and certainly throughout the early modern period, and on into the modern period, actually, the Aragonese, the Valencians, and perhaps especially the Catalans were unhappy with being ruled from Castile, because once Carlos I of Spain, Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire, once he inherited Spain and then it was passed on to his successors, this thing we call Spain became very much a Castile-centered empire, and the capital, which came to be Madrid, was in Castile, and the peoples of the Crown of Aragon were not too happy with being ruled from Castile and by a Castile-centered king. And so, for instance, the Catalans famously revolted in the 1640s against the Castilian monarchy because of excessive taxation, other political demands that were being placed on the Catalans without the consent of their representative assemblies. The Catalans rebelled. They actually remained under French dominion for a few years before Castile took Catalonia back. So just a very fragile relationship. And to this day, the Catalans are somewhat ambivalent about their relationship with Castile, and there's still a vigorous separatist movement in Catalonia and many parts of Spain, not just the former Crown of Aragon. So there's long been a problematic relationship between the Castilian center and the rest of the peninsula.
Yeah, having spent quite a bit of time in Girona in the last few years, particularly during these moments when the separative movement in Catalonia has broken out into violence, it's been very prevalent in my mind in thinking about it, because for my students, Girona is one of the centers of that separatist movement. And one of the leaders of the separatist movement is the former mayor of Girona. When Alexander and I were in Spain right after some of the violence had happened during the attempts of the referendum vote, and our Catalan friends there were really struggling. Many of them spoke about what had happened with a lot of emotion because they didn't know what path that they were going down, right? Where their country was going. So I think that's one of the things that's important for our students to understand, that the implications of what happens in the time period we study are longstanding and are still not settled even today.
Spain was for over 30 years under dictatorship of Francisco Franco, who died in 1975. And one of the things that the Franco regime did was, I know in Catalonia, because some of my Catalan friends' parents have told me about this and spoken about it very passionately, they forbid the teaching of Catalan. Catalans couldn't even study in their own language. They had to be more Castilianized. So after Franco's death, there was a major resurgence of Catalan culture because so much had been suppressed during the Franco period.
So on the one hand, we have this political union that happens between this couple that are married in various ways, or this myth, at least, that these Spanish kingdoms were unified under this couple. But there's a second aspect to this related to conversion. So this is the other thread, I think, that you had mentioned before. So how does conversion play into this idea of the unification under these monarchs?
It's a major factor, because if we look at the reign of Fernando and Isabel, we see certain things happening on the ground that lead to an interpretation that Fernando and Isabel, once they were governing both Castile and the Crown of Aragon, decided that the best way to really consolidate their rule over both realms and to unify the two realms was to make everyone Catholic, one realm, one religion. And it's a very persuasive and compelling interpretation that has really dominated the historiography for a long time. Even as historians recognize that the Crown of Aragon is a very different beast, still they see Fernando and Isabel as trying to unify the realms through religion. And if we look at the main event, so to speak, it seems on the surface that this was the case. For instance, Fernando and Isabel established the Spanish Inquisition, which is really a Castilian-run institution, in 1480 for the purpose of prosecuting and rooting out from among the converted Jewish population, which had been around since 1391, tens of thousands of converted Jews and their descendants. The Inquisition was established to prosecute and root out the Judaizers among the converso population, which is to say, conversos who continued to practice Judaism in some way, shape, or form. These people were baptized Catholics, so if they're practicing Judaism, they were regarded as heretics as far as the Catholic Church was concerned and as far as Fernando and Isabel were concerned. And these Judaizing conversos were seen to be a serious threat to the Spanish Catholic Church, infecting it on the inside. And there were a lot of these people, especially in the urban centers. Which isn't to say that all conversos were Judaizing, many weren't, but a good, a healthy percentage were. Point being is that this problem of converso Judaizing was a problem in both Castile and the Crown of Aragon, and therefore the Inquisition was extended from Castile, where various tribunals were established, to the Crown of Aragon, and quite rapidly. And what's interesting is that scholars who argue that Isabel and Fernando were doing this to strengthen their authority in the different parts of their realms, actually in the Crown of Aragon, if anything, the new Inquisition caused a lot of opposition among Catalans and Valencians and Aragonese, because they saw this new institution as Castilian run, and they saw it as a violation of their regional laws and constitution, and it caused quite a bit of controversy. So it actually didn't win Fernando the love of his subjects. But Fernando pointed out to them, look, we've got these Judaizing conversos, we got to deal with them, we must root them out because this kind of heresy is too much of a problem. So that's one element of the story of religious unification. The other one is the expulsion of the Jews in 1492. From both Castile and the Crown of Aragon. Why from both places? Again, the Inquisition was operating in both realms. The Inquisition, if you read Inquisition records, they dug up a lot of evidence, not only of converso Judaizing, but also of Jews, unbaptized Jews, and there were still a good number of them in various parts of Castile and the Crown of Aragon. Evidence of unbaptized Jews influencing conversos to continue to practice Judaism, educating them in Judaism, reading Hebrew prayers to them, teaching them how to read Hebrew, providing them with kosher food, doing various things to help conversos be Jewish if they so chose. And with all this evidence of that, Fernando and Isabel decided that after conferring with the inquisitors that the best way of getting all conversos, they hoped, to sincerely embrace Catholicism was to get rid of the Jewish influence. And so that's what they did. They expelled all the Jews in 1492, around 100,000 people, more or less. Some Jews chose to remain and convert rather than go into exile. Again, in terms of this question of everyone being on the bandwagon of conversion and expulsion, it's not at all clear that Christians in various local communities were all that keen on seeing their Jewish neighbors expelled. There were a number of towns and cities where Christians got along with their Jewish neighbors enough, and where Jews were well integrated into the local economies, and that Christians depended on Jews and vice versa in different ways economically. It's not as if there was this great uproar of Christians in all the towns and cities of Spain calling for the expulsion of the Jews. It's the case in some places, for sure, but in other places, it was not. And then finally, we have this 10-year-long campaign conducted by Fernando Nisabel against the Sultan of Granada, the last Muslim state on Iberian soil. And this was a joint Castilian-Aragonese enterprise, although, again, Fernando Nisabel were able to draw much more upon the fiscal and military resources of Castile because it was much wealthier and much stronger militarily. But what's interesting there is that once Granada was conquered, initially, Isabel and Fernando offered the conquered Muslims the same deal they had given conquered Muslims in previous centuries, which is to say that as long as you remain politically obedient, pay your taxes, you can practice Islam, you can have your Islamic courts, etc., etc. But what happened is that in 1499, Archbishop Cardinal Francisco Jiménez de Cisneros went down to Granada and began forcibly converting certain Granadan Muslims to Christianity. These were Granadan Muslims who were the descendants of Christians who had at some point gone to Granada, converted to Islam, and so it was either them or their children or grandchildren who were being converted. And this caused a major rebellion in Granada and then rebellions throughout the recently conquered Sultanate. And during the suppression of these rebellions, Isabel and Fernando offered, because the Muslims were now seen as having rebelled, as having violated the surrender treaties, offered them the choice of conversion or exile or possibly slavery. And that's what happened in Granada. Almost all the Muslims were forcibly coerced to convert. And then in 1502, Fernando Nisabel decided that they would do the same thing for Castilian Muslims. Now, Granada became a part of Castile. In Castile, there had actually been, relatively speaking, very few Muslims living in Castile, only around 20,000 or so Muslims, whereas in the Crown of Aragon, the Muslim population was very large. But what's interesting is that Fernando and Isabel, especially Fernando, who didn't seem too keen on what Cisneros had done with the forced conversions and all that, but when they talked about why they were converting the Muslims, they talked about the problem with Jews and conversos. In other words, the problem with that, as they saw it, is that because there were some unbaptized Jews and then there were conversos, it left the door open for unbaptized Jews to influence the converts. In the case of the Muslims, they figured, why don't we just convert all the Muslims and then we won't have unbaptized Muslims around to influence baptized Muslims. Now, they weren't silly enough to think that automatically the newly forcibly, coercively baptized Muslims would become sincere Catholics, but they figured over the course of two or three generations they would. Then what's really interesting is in the Crown of Aragon, and that's where outside of the Muslim state of Granada, most Muslims lived in Christian Spain. A third of the population of the Kingdom of Valencia was Muslim. A fifth of the population of the Kingdom of Aragon was Muslim. Only around 5% in Catalonia. And this is the one thing that throws a wrench in the works of the supposedly grand design of Fernando and Isabel to unify their realms religiously and therefore strengthen their position politically, is that Fernando opposed the conversion of his Muslim subjects in the lands of the Crown of Aragon. Throughout his reign, they were never converted. Why? Partly because he was very opposed to the notion of forced conversion because he saw the problem it caused among the conversos. Also, in the Crown of Aragon, most Muslims lived on the lands of the Christian nobility, and the Christian nobility did not want their Muslim tenants converted because they didn't want their tenants upset. They didn't want their tenants to pack their bags and try and leave the kingdom. So it's much more complicated than I think historians often recognize.
Yeah, I think what ends up happening is the story that gets told is you have this couple that comes to the throne. Often the path of Isabel's way to the throne, the fact that it was a very tenuous hold on the throne, right, for quite a long time. People focus on the fact that these two come to the throne and they have this plan and that they do these three things that we think about, the conquest of Granada, the expulsion of the Jews, and the creation of the Spanish Inquisition, and that all of these, they succeed easily at all of this. And then at the end, they have this united Catholic country with a united politically. And it's just simply not a true story. Because I think the complicated story, the one that you've told, is much more interesting because it gets much more at the heart of how they were as individuals, right? The fact that Fernando, he understood things within his own realm and resisted these things, I think was more reflective of his own political concerns as distinct from Isabel's, right? And distinct from Castile. I should say too that Alexandra and I actually have Inquisition records from the early 15th century where Jewish converts, so converted or so men are accused of Judaizing, and they get into trouble with the medieval Inquisition because their wives are still Jewish. So the men convert, but their wives don't, and their children don't. And the bishop gets upset, and the inquisitors get involved, and the king steps in and protects the families. So the picture that's presented in this argument, therefore, about this image of Fernando and Isabel and the Spain that they construct is therefore one of a united Spain, right? This the one that's politically unified under Fernando and Isabel and religiously unified under one faith, Catholicism. And I think you've already highlighted how we should think about these reigns of Fernando and Isabel, how the story behind it is much more complex. So what advice would you give to students and how they should approach studying these monarchs, but also this time period in terms of religion as well?
I think we have to look at many of these issues at the local and regional level. The societies we're dealing with, for the most part, are quintessentially local societies. That's a tautology to say local societies. But what I mean is that their horizons were not very distant, except for the chief politicians and so forth, and some of the more learned classes and certain merchants. Their vision of their social and religious worlds was pretty circumscribed. And so if we try and think about Christian, Muslim, Jewish relations during the reign of Fernando and Isabel and the preceding decades, it's really helpful to look at this at the local level. And when we do that, and we have increasing numbers of local studies that enable us to do that, we see a great diversity of relationships between the three religious groups. Some of this is based on demography. Obviously, in places like Aragon and Valencia, where there were so many Muslims, Christians would tend to have a different view of Muslims, greater familiarity with them, almost necessarily cooperating with them and collaborating with them at times, at least for economic purposes. Same thing with Christians and Jews in a good number of towns. There are those kind of demographic factors and economic factors that create a relationship, but could also sometimes create resentments and so forth. Say, for instance, Jewish money lending or something like that, which remained more of an issue in Castile than it did in the Crown of Aragon. Also in Castile, if we take political cultures into account in the different realms, we see that Castile and the Crown of Aragon had very different political cultures, especially the role that what we might call anti-Judaism and Islamophobia maybe came into play, which is to say that because the monarchy in Castile was in many ways more authoritarian and the representative assemblies tended to be weak, the noble opponents of the Castilian monarchs, and I don't mean just opponents of Fernando and Isabel, because they dealt with their noble opponents pretty effectively. But from the 14th century, we see noble opponents of Castilian monarchs actually using anti-Jewish and anti-Islamic tropes in their anti-monarchical propaganda to gain support. For instance, saying that, oh, the king is a Jew lover and he has all these Jewish officials who are influencing him. And oh, look, he's got Muslim soldiers at his court and on. And so painting a very negative picture of the monarchy. And there's no doubt that if we look at the violence against the Jews in 1391, which began in Castile, that this tradition of using anti-Jewish tropes and political propaganda, which was so strong in Castile from the mid-14th century on, was a factor in enabling those who were promoting violence against the Jews in 1391. It was a factor in gaining the promoters of the violence support. We look at the Crown of Aragon, by contrast, because of the great parliamentary constitutional tradition, it's not that there wasn't anti-Judaism and anti-Islamic feeling in the Crown of Aragon. Of course, there was. But in terms of the larger political discourse, the kind of discourse that tended to whip up people's feelings and cause them to engage in violence, in the Crown of Aragon, when people wanted to oppose the monarchy, when Christians wanted to oppose the monarchy, they talked a lot less about Muslims and Jews and talked a lot more about their constitutional liberties, about what the laws say, about you can't tax us until you redress our various grievances. So a very different kind of political tradition, which framed Jewish, Christian, Jewish, Muslim relations in very different ways. So I think to deal with these kinds of issues, we do have to look at things at the local level more and try and understand what was affecting Christians, Muslims, and Jews in different local and regional contexts. And the other things we have to take into consideration, for instance, especially when we look at monarchs like Fernando and Isabel, there were a lot of royal chroniclers writing in their reign, mainly Castilian chroniclers, actually, which is telling in and of itself. And they were royal propagandists. And we have to be careful not to take what the chroniclers say at face value. Because some of the chroniclers, they also try to present these great monarchs coming to power and getting rid of the enemies of the faith. And isn't it all so wonderful? So they make it a nice, neat package, and they tend to paper over all the inconsistencies and contradictions and messiness. And I think as historians, we need to think more about the different agendas of court chroniclers and later chroniclers who tend to look at Fernando and Isabel almost as saintly monarchs and look at their agendas and think harder about what these chroniclers are saying. And I think finally, we also, as historians, have to look more at our own, you might say, biases. Because we all have our own political identities and predilections, our religious identities, our racialized identities, and so forth. And so the way in which we view a reign like the one of Fernando and Isabel is going to vary a lot depending on our particular perspectives and agendas. Obviously, we have to try to do our best to be what we might say somewhat objective. We also have to be honest with ourselves about our own blinders, our own prejudices. And so it's not simply more traditional observant Catholic historians who tend to perpetuate this notion of one kingdom, one faith, because actually a lot of more liberally minded historians tend to do the same thing at times, because in a number of ways, for very good reason, the world we live in and the world we have lived in for a while, we're very sensitive to things like religious and, you know, racial oppression and persecution. And we want to understand the roots of it. It's absolutely essential in the world in which we live and in grappling with our different pasts. But in a way, for, I guess you might say, more liberally minded scholars, it becomes fashionable and trendy and useful to look at Fernando and Isabel as just these oppressive, almost fanatical Catholic monarchs who were hell-bent on imposing Christianity on Jews and Muslims, or ridding their realm of Jews and Muslims, because it fits into this larger narrative of a history of persecution. And I'm not denying that persecution didn't go on. It certainly did. I spent a lot of time reading Spanish Inquisition records and read a lot of things about expelled peoples and all of that. So I understand all this deeply, and it moves me a lot. But still, we have to look at all those inconsistencies, all the contradictions, and sometimes even reading the records, like Inquisition records, that talk about violence against Muslims and Jews or persecution, you find sometimes the most incredible evidence of people getting along and people, you know, actually defending their Jewish and Muslim neighbors. Can I give you one example?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that'd be great.
This is something that happened after the reign of Isabel and Fernando, but what led to the conversion of the Muslims to the crown of Aragon was the rebellion of the Germania, which translates into the Brotherhood. It was a rebellion mainly of artisans from the city of Valencia and also from other cities and towns in the kingdom of Valencia against the nobility and against the monarchy. And these Germania rebels had a kind of millenarian ideology, which is to say they wanted to create what they saw as a new kingdom of heaven on earth, a Christian paradise. And from their perspective, this involved converting the Muslims to Christianity. Now, what made this more politically complicated and figured into their political agenda as well, since they opposed the nobility, they opposed the Christian elite, and ultimately opposed the monarchy, is that most Muslims lived on the lands of the nobility, and some of them actually served in the nobles' armies when they fought against the Germania. But what's very interesting, when the Germania went around, there was a major battle in the summer of 1521, July the 25th, 1521, called the Battle of Gandia. And Germania's army was victorious. And this meant that Muslim communities were exposed to the Germania army. And what's interesting is that when the Germania army went around, they offered the Muslims the choice of baptism or death. Now, you might say that's not much of a choice. It's the same choice that was offered to Jews in 1391. You unpack baptism or death, it's a lot more complicated. Because when you look at a lot of the Christians who engaged in violence against Jews in 1391 or against Muslims in 1521, these were often the people who had the closest relationships with Muslims and Jews. And so they were giving people with whom they were familiar the choice to join us. And there's evidence, I'm simplifying, but there's evidence that the Germania, when they talked about brotherhood, they wanted the Muslims to be their brothers.
Their brothers.
They preferred that they be baptized. At least some of them were violent soldiers and all that. But the other incredible thing about the Germania rebellion, There's a remarkable document from 1524 where the Inquisition, they wanted to see under what conditions were the Muslims being baptized? Were the baptisms legitimate? And of course, they decided the baptisms were legitimate, just like they did in 1391.
Yeah.
But what's so interesting is that 131 Christian witnesses were interviewed. It comes through in these documents. And this is a time when Christians are supposedly all hating Muslims and wanting to convert them, get rid of them. It comes through in this document in some of these Christian testimonies that there were Christians who, when the Hermannia soldiers arrived, who defended their Muslim neighbor. There were Christian villagers who went out of their way because they thought that if they didn't get some of these Muslims to a church and get them baptized, the Hermannia soldiers were going to slaughter them. There are individual Christian villagers who went out of their way to save hundreds of Muslims' lives. So in the heat of this rebellion, when all this horrible stuff is going on, there are Christians who are standing up for Muslims in different ways, and it's absolutely extraordinary.
We have similar examples from 1391. We found notarial records that detail Christians returning property to their Jewish neighbors that they had hidden for them during the violence, or speaking about the fact that they had hidden Jews in their households so that they would be protected from the violence as well. Clearly, if you paint this picture of everyone having one perspective, you lose these stories, right, which are really crucial for us and understanding how these communities functioned on a day-to-day level, on an individual, personal level.
One thing we have to take into account, and it might seem like a strange point to make, is what I would call fundamental human decency. These people came to know each other. Even though they didn't live next door to each other, they came to know each other in different ways. And once your supposed religious enemy has a human face like that, someone you get to know, it's not so easy to be nasty, to be murderous, and so forth. And the problem we have as historians is this, something to take into account. In the period with which we're dealing, this pre-modern period, there's no language for talking positively about getting along with non-Christians. I don't mean just Christians didn't have this language. Muslims and Jews didn't really have it either. There's obviously none of these people thought the other religion was equal. Nobody thought that. They all thought their own religion was better. But they didn't really have any language of talking about, for the most part, the fundamental human rights of these people. Why should we protect them? Why shouldn't they be forcibly converted, etc.? There was no language for this. And of course, at least in Christian Spain, there weren't Christians who felt comfortable going around talking about rights for Muslims and rights for Jews.
Yeah.
But it was this fundamental informal relationships that developed in this gut level, visceral, a sense of human decency that we're not going to kill these people. We're going to help them sometimes. We're going to, as you say, take care of their property, maybe hide them in our houses, etc. Because it just seems like the right thing to do, even though there's not really much of a language for it in our sources.
We find these individual moments in those sources, I think, that help us tell a much richer story, I think, about what life was like for them. So one of the things that we've been thinking a lot about in the podcast episodes that I've been doing, but also more broadly in our course on medieval Spain, is why certain historical myths persist and the impact of those myths on our present, particularly around identity. So when we talked about both convivencia and Reconquista, and we talked about why these ideas have persisted, particularly in Spain, but also the role they've played in the developing Spanish identity in the 19th and 20th centuries in particular. So why do you think that this myth of unification has been so persistent, but also what purpose has it served in terms of constructing Spanish identity in the 19th and 20th centuries?
Oh, I think it's played a prominent role in the construction of Spanish identity. If we think of the Franco regime, for instance, whose ruling ideology was a complicated mixture of fascism and Catholicism, this myth was very much propounded and embraced by many people, especially, and you might say, the more traditional Castilian heartland. Why? Because especially through much of the 20th century and 19th until recently, whatever their regional affiliations, most Spaniards were fairly deeply Catholic in some ways. I think that's a fair enough characterization, or at least they saw themselves as Catholic within the framework of the church. And so at the very least, that gave a form of unity. But it's also served other kinds of political purposes. More recently, we see that this sense of Catholic unity and Catholic destiny from Muslim conquest to the Christian reconquest to the reign of Fernando de Isabel, and then to Spaniards going to America to convert all the indigenous peoples there, triumphant Catholicism still persists in certain conservative political circles. We see political parties like the Volksparty, which has a lot of influence in Andalusia, which had been the heartland of Muslim Spain. You see the Volksparty and other politicians opposing the immigration of Muslims from North Africa, or even Black Africans who may or may not be Christian or Muslim. And that kind of myth of Catholic Spain, and this is our destiny, has played an important political role. But also the history of political unification, again, the Spanish reconquest, the unification of Spain under Isabel and Fernando. This has also played an explicit political role in that it delegitimizes the political identities, the political yearnings of Catalans, Basques, take the most famous examples, for if not outright independence, at least more regional autonomy. It suggests that somehow, instead of this being part of a longer history, that somehow they are doing something very un-Spanish. It plays into all these kinds of things. But by the same token, there has been in Spain, certainly in academic circles and among younger people who are more plugged into newer historiographies, newer methodologies, and the wider world in different ways, to think about the history of their own country in a different way, to think about it as much more problematic in terms of what was done to Muslims and Jews and Black Africans and indigenous peoples. And again, to be much more critical. But as I suggested before, sometimes they can be so critical and uniformly, oh, look at the horrible things that our monarchs did, or look how horrible our Christian ancestors were to Muslims and Jews, that they sometimes kind of paper over the more benign, productive relationships between the religious groups. So it's very complicated, but these remain very lively, debated topics. And hardly needs to be said that these kinds of discussions very much intersect with the kinds of discussions we're having now in North America about race as constructed and as a source of discrimination and continuing violence against Black people and persecution, and also questions of indigeneity and the position of indigenous peoples. These are all extremely important live questions, and that's why we constantly have to keep interrogating our own narratives and our own perspectives.
I think a lot about as a medieval European historian that the narrative that I construct in the classes that I teach, which are these survey classes, that my students don't walk away thinking it's an easy story, that I want them to walk away thinking this is a complex story and we have to pay attention to those complexities, because it is not an either or. It's not they're these wonderful Catholic monarchs that we should celebrate, nor that they're these terrible people that persecuted everyone, that we have to think about both of those and everything in between too, because otherwise on our own, we're rewriting that history in a way that's problematic as well. So how do you think the Spanish government's fairly recent decision to give Spanish citizenship to Sephardic Jews plays into all of this? I'm curious about your thoughts on their motivations behind this. What do you think their goal is? And I should preface for my students that I guess it's about 6 years ago now, the Spanish government passed a law allowing Jews that could prove that they were of Sephardic heritage to access Spanish citizenship within certain conditions. You have to do a Spanish citizenship test, and you have to show connection to Spain in some way, and also you have to pass a language test is the other. So what do you think about their decision behind that?
That's an interesting question. I think there has been this effort in some way, shape, or form, and I've noticed it since the, I don't think celebration is the right word, the memorialization of, you know, the 500th anniversary of the expulsion of the Jews in 1492 and of the conquest of Granada in 1492. And all that ensued. And this is the newer Spain after the Franco regime, a serious attempt by more thoughtful Spaniards and the Spanish government in some way to come to grips with this past, and in some way to make some gestures towards what we might call a reparation and reconciliation. And rather than seeing the Muslim and Jewish past as something that should be shunned or swept under the carpet, which had been the case certainly during the Franco regime, something to embrace and something you one might say to be proud of. Now, some people suggest that it's also a bit of a crass attempt to cultivate more tourism from Jews and Muslims. Yeah. And certainly there are various tourist sites that cater to tourists who are interested in these kinds of histories, but I think it's well-meaning. I remember being at a conference at the University of Southern California in 1992 on Sephardic history, Spanish Jewish history. And there was a conference ceremony, you might say, held in the Sephardic synagogue in Los Angeles. And it's a beautiful building built in the style and quote unquote Moorish style, mm-hmm. the horseshoe arches. But what was so striking, I'll never forget this, because in 1992, King Juan Carlos had formally readmitted the Jews to Spain, should they, you know, choose to. And what was striking is that some people in the congregation were talking about a certain excitement about the king having readmitted the Jews. But the way they were talking about it was as if Juan Carlos were still their king.
Interesting.
It was a very powerful moment. It's not as if all these people packed their bags and moved
to Spain. Yeah.
Very few, if any, did. Yeah. But just symbolically, it meant a lot because these Sephardic families, over the course of centuries, a good number of them, and they moved to all kinds of different places, retained memories. Some of them continued to speak Ladino, which is basically the 15th, 16th century dialect of Castilian Spanish, a bit inflected by some Hebrew words and so forth. So it's just a very interesting kind of thing to witness. So I do think that these moves by the Spanish government are, on the whole, well-meaning, an attempt at consciousness raising, an attempt at rethinking their history as a peninsula in the Mediterranean, which is in contact with so many Muslim countries and with Israel. And there are obviously complications in those relationships because of the reverberations of 9/11 and some fears of Muslim violence in Spain. Obviously, in Spain, there's good amount of criticism of Israel's policies toward Palestinians and so forth. So it's not all complicated, but I think those gestures were on the whole positive and well-meaning and encouraging.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if they decide to do the same with Muslims, because that has been brought to the government twice and has failed. So we'll see if they ever do that. So just to wrap up our discussion here, what advice would you give to students to challenge this representation then of this story of one of unification? What role do historians play in doing that, in writing, in presenting a story that's more reflective of the past?
Well, again, I think I suggested this before, but I think the question of looking at these different local and regional histories, and trying to understand how the three religious groups coped with certain levels of religious antagonism, managed to get along or sometimes didn't, and the factors that played into all that. It's also important, I think, to try and get beyond what we call Spanish history and an historiography at times that can be very Castile-centric, because Castile was the center of what became the Spanish Empire. It's important to take into account the regional diversity. I'm not just talking about religious diversity, but also the regional diversity, the history of Catalans, of Aragonese, of Valencians, of Castilians, for that matter, etc., because it's a large peninsula with very diverse populations, regional traditions. And I think it's important to look at all those, or at least those that might interest us most, or the problems that might interest us most. But I think this fundamental diversity is really important to keep in mind, and also the historiographical diversity to be aware of the different interpretations, not simply to take one author's word for things, but to look for the different opinions and to look at the different debates and to think them through. And I think one of the things we learn as students of history and as professional historians is that, yes, there's a certain framework of quote unquote facts that we can hang our hats on and that we cannot ignore. Obviously, facts are in their way facts, and new ones are being uncovered all the time. But it's also a question of how we interpret them. And I always tell students this in my classes, feel free when we're discussing things, say what you want to say, speak your mind, because there's no set right or wrong interpretation for operating within this framework of the obvious facts. There's so much to rethink. There's so much that needs to be discussed. And that's why sometimes when you're a working historian, you're thinking about maybe working on a certain project and you that, oh, some years ago, Professor X wrote this book on that. Maybe I've got nothing new to say and all that. Or you're sometimes wondering, hey, a book has already been written about that. Why is this historian doing that again? But fact of the matter is that every generation sees things a bit differently. Every generation, because of their own histories, their own surroundings, thinks about things in new ways, wants to make history meaningful to them. Again, within that frame, I keep emphasizing this, within the framework of facts, we can't just say anything and rethink and reinterpret a lot and just keep our minds as open as we can.